Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee with our head coach, Chad Zimmerman.
Hi, everybody.
Our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hello.
And as you can hear, we are not in our normal studio. We're with a special guest, Ryan Cooper of Best Bike Split. What's up, man?
Hey, doing great. I'm loving it out here. It's a little bit different than the normal office environment here.
So yeah, no doubt.
It's nice.
Yeah, where are we?
Well, right now we are sitting right next to the ocean in Hawaii, in Kona, Hawaii, right here for the World Championship. So
heck yeah. We're at a coffee shop. If you hear any noises in the background, hopefully it just adds to the ambiance and it doesn't distract.
I'm not eating, everyone, just so you know. It's not me if you hear it.
Yep. So we're here today to talk all about aerodynamics but pacing as well, really. Like, how, in other words, to best pace a TT and all the different factors that weigh into that, because that's what Best Bike Split does. We've mentioned it a lot on the podcast. I use it before every race I do, actually, to try to get an estimation of what my time, ideal time would be. And then I work off of that as like a point. Even on mountain biking stuff, I've adjusted my CDA, probably not advisable, but I've just adjusted my CDA down to where it seems like it replicates what I've done on a course, and then I kind of save that as like a separate thing. So anyways, it's a really good way to find out a proper pacing and get an idea of what pacing you should do. But should we get into a little bit of Best Bike Split and the history behind it first, Nate?
Yeah. So, Ryan, what did you do? Can you describe what Best Bike Split is, and then how did you get started?
Sure. Best Bike Split, actually, I got started. I was listening to a symposium. It was called Math and Cycling. It was at the University of Utah. This was back in 2013, and they streamed this live, and they had PhDs on there talking about different ways they were using math and how it related to cycling. Jim Miller Jim Martin was kind of hosting this thing, a professor there, and they had a German PhD student on, and he was talking about optimal pacing strategy, and he said, okay, all we have to do is have the athlete ride the course a couple of times, pre-ride the course a couple of times, then we take that, and we're going to look at some data around that, and then we're going to run a model, and then 3 days later, we're going to get this this great strategy. And I said, there's got to be a better way than that. So it kind of got my mind going, and I had, my wife was pregnant, and we were about to have our first child, and so I took some paternity leave, and there wasn't really much I could do. There's a little baby, and I was like, well, I can kind of play with him a little bit, but I can also do some math modeling. So the tour was going on, and so I wrote the very first math model that ended up becoming Best Bike Split. And originally, all it did was basically predict time. So it was, you kind of put in some parameters around aerodynamics, you broke a course up, and I manually broke the time trial up into all these different sections. And basically predicted times for various athletes. So I think Alberto Contador, Tony Martin, Chris Froome, and some of the other this was 2013, so some of the other contenders. And I remember I finished it at like 2 in the morning, time trial was the next day, and I'm telling my wife, I'm all excited, and I'm telling, oh, I think they're going to do all this, and she just doesn't care. She's like, I just had a baby, what is wrong with you? And I was like, oh, I'm all excited. And so the next day, I told her all these times, I had them written down, and then the next day the times start coming in, and so we start to see it, and it's like Chris Froome, or I think Alberto Contador's first was like 3 seconds off of his time, and then whoa, 2 seconds off another time, and 9 seconds off another time, and she's like, oh, now she got more interested. She goes, well, what can we do with it? And so I'm going on the betting sites trying to say, like, oh, how much? It's like, oh, there's not a lot of good betting on cycling. It's weird. There's some prop bets. But yeah. It actually didn't occur to me to a couple days later. And I think on Slow Twitch, they actually posted Tony Martin's race plan for that. And he had the course broken down into, I think, 40 to 60 different sections of that 19-mile time trial.
Wow.
So he had it broken down, every little nook and cranny. I mean, he was so just strategic about how he's going to ride it. And I said, that's what it is. That's what we need. We need the plan. We need to say, here's how you should, not just what your time's going to be, but how to get the best possible time for your given ability. And so that's where it kind of took off from there and became what it is now.
And didn't you actually, though, make some public predictions before it?
Yes, yeah.
Can you describe those?
So we did a few, and one of my favorite ones was a young pro at the time, Josh Amberger, was racing 70.3 Worlds for the first time in Vegas. And we went on and we said, okay, before this race, we think Amberger is going to do a 2-hour and 15-minute bike ride. And he posted all his power data, so we had a pretty good idea of you know, what he was capable of doing. And we tweeted that out, and he came back and tweeted us back and said, no, expletive, a couple other things. He said, no, that's no way. I'm going to go way faster than that. I think he said, your model's shite. And I was like, all right, or rubbish or something. Yeah. And I was like, okay. And sure enough, he goes out and rides. And, you know, whether that got in his head or not, I don't know. But he goes out and rides a 2:15:20 or something. So within 20 seconds for the 70.3. He actually tweets us back apologizing. We get in touch, and then we start working with him for all his, you know, major races the next year. So it was really cool to kind of get that feedback directly from the pros fairly early on. And then that kind of snowballed into working with Trek Factory Racing and doing some modeling work where they have an internal model that they use for aerodynamics and their engineering team. And so we compared the best bike split model versus their internal model to see the kind of the differences. And it worked out well enough to where our internal model was very similar to theirs. It's just maybe a 1,000-fold increase in speed. So if it takes 6 hours to run one, it was taking about 0.5 seconds to run ours. So
sweet.
So it ended up being a good combination for both of us. So yeah,
that's cool. And this partially solves so many people, and you know this, if you've ridden a course, you think, should I hammer it up this hill? Should I pace it evenly? Should I go harder on the backside? It's always wondering where to place that power, and that's what this solves.
What is, in general, like, for people who don't use best bike split, what is proper pacing if you're doing this is all solo time trials, right? Not draft legal or draft legal stuff, correct?
Yes. So I would say primarily it's all time trials or triathlon, which basically a time trial followed by two hard things on both sides, two harder things in my opinion. But yeah, so for the most part, it's time trial and triathlon. However, going to the tour this year, We work with 4 or 5 tour teams, and then I found out that there were several other teams using it, and they weren't just using it for time trials. They were also looking at things like strategic places to potentially make breaks.
Yeah.
What you can do on different parts of the hill. So if you can ramp your watts per kilo on a certain section of hill, how much gap can you get over somebody else?
Yep.
And then looking for places where if you do push a really high watts per kilo, can you recover in another section and then do it again? And where can you kind of find those places on the course?
So let's say I'm doing a time trial and it's a rolling course, and my FTP is 300 watts. Like, is it the best thing to do? Is it just to pace 300 watts the whole time?
Gotcha.
Or what? Tell me, like, what's?
Yeah.
What is it?
So I mean, physics-wise, I mean, there is some variability to that. So you know, if you're going out and you're pacing 300 watts the whole time, and you have up and down, and especially if there's a lot of climbing involved, what you'll find is that it's not going to be the fastest way to get from point A to point B. So you could go the same normalized power. So let's say you did 300 normalized, your average may only be 290 or 285, and you could actually go faster than you did at that average of 300, depending on the course. And so if it's a perfectly flat course and the wind direction, there's no wind, then 300, just hold it steady as you can. You're going to do great. But if there's any kind of wind conditions, like there are here in Kona, you're definitely going to want to vary that strategy a little bit, because if you push that same wattage into the wind that you do into the headwind that you do in the tailwind, you're actually going to be giving up some time in the headwind that you're not gaining back in the tailwind.
That's an interesting point. And that's also something that I see in very proficient triathletes, especially, which is always funny to see cyclists go out with really professional level triathletes and just get dropped through stuff, you know, because they don't realize how good they are at placing their power strategically over stuff and not killing themselves on the climbs, but doing whatever they need to and then being able to keep the power down. I just want to add I don't want to make you blush, Ryan, but a testimonial to this. On the solo brake thing, I think that's a way that best bike split could be used by road cyclists. There was a race and I was planning on trying a solo brake, and I did it 15 minutes in, and then I had about 2 hours by myself thereafter. And best bike split it was, I think it was something like 26 seconds off, which was pretty darn good, man, nice. For that. So for a person like, and it was a full exhaustive effort. I almost got caught by the pack as it came in. So that's something that I think you could really, if you do look at a course and you think this might be a good chance where I could break away here, do something like that. It gave me a key to know exactly what I needed to do in those spots. So it's awesome. Yeah.
So you're doing all this modeling. How important, you know, cyclists are always talking about weight. How important is the aerodynamic side versus weight? Because I know in your software I can like say, what if I lost 1 pound or what if I got a little more aero?
Yeah, and especially in a triathlon or in a TT event, in triathlon especially, 95% of the courses, 99% of the courses, aerodynamics is going to trump weight almost every time. You know, there's just not enough climbing in those kind of races to where weight starts to matter that much. I mean, the general rule of thumb is if you're not going, you know, slower than, say, 12, 13 miles an hour, then aerodynamics is going to, that's kind of the breaking point where weight and aerodynamics start to really kind of weigh each other out.
So would that be where I should, like, if I'm on a road bike, when should I be in the drops? When can I, like, start to, get, you know, get kind of sit up taller so put out more power on a climb?
Right. So, I mean, I think you can kind of feel it, right? When your momentum starts to slow down, and then you can kind of say, okay, well, you look down, you go, oh, I'm going about 12 miles an hour, 13 miles an hour. So I'm going to start changing the way I ride. So the faster you go, the more important it is. So you can kind of look at it that way. So you always kind of cringe. You see some of the riders that get up dancing out of the saddle, and it's like, and, I mean, really, if you see them, the people sitting in the saddle is going to be better than the up out of the saddle. You know, even if they're dropping, you know, 5-10 watts, they're still going to be more efficient usually. So
you're saying maybe around 12 or 13 is when I can kind of like not
worry
so much.
That's where you can be out of the saddle and you can be
saddle. I can be sitting up.
You can be sitting up. You can do those kind of things. You see it in some of the tour, even in some of the latest world championship time trial, they had a bike switch possibility, right?
That was awesome. Yeah.
But it's actually interesting because they put the bike exchange down at the bottom of the climb, right? So if you think about it, you're coming around and you have all that momentum, and now you've got to stop all that momentum at the bottom of the climb, not stop the momentum up where you hit those slow speeds. So, you know, the ideal bike change point wasn't at that point. It was probably 100 and 200 meters up the road, up as you started going the climb. So you lose not only the momentum and the bike change time, but then the time it takes to get back up to that same speed that you lost.
And the energy costs.
Right. And so you see somebody like Dumoulin who didn't change, and, you know, maybe, you know, would he have gotten any time? He definitely wasn't going to lose that much time, right? So, you know, you take 20 seconds maybe all in all. Well, it's kind of a wash, but a lot of the top pros that end up doing really well didn't do the bike change. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I almost wonder if that was intentional by them to put the bike change down low like that to make it a more complex decision. Because there's so many factors that come into it, momentum and everything.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Another thing that people struggle with a lot, and I've struggled with it before too, as a tall and very skinny guy. We've mentioned this before.
Very skinny.
Oh, yeah, very skinny.
Thanks, guys. I was fishing. Yeah. The power versus weight. Like, when should I use weight and when should I use power? And just with Mauna Kea, which they did, I didn't get to do it, but I was doing, like, the adjustments, and for every pound I lost, I think it was, like, a minute. But then for every watt I gained, it was a minute. Like,
yeah.
Like, that just blows my mind. Yeah. I can't lose 30 watt or 30 pounds, but I can gain 30 watts.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, you know, think about it that way, yeah. So there's a certain point where you just can't get any skinnier. Especially, you know, I'm looking at you now. So
I could get a little skinnier, but it would be hard, and I think I would lose power.
Yeah, and so you'd lose power. So if you can think that you can gain power, then that would be a place, you know, watts per kilo, it will matter on some of those grades. So for those of you who are listening who don't know, that's about a 14,000-foot climb from sea level up to 14,000 feet, or a little over 14,000 feet.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty big climb. So weight will play a big factor there, but power is the other side of that equation. So if you can more easily gain power, then, you know, I would err on that side than trying to go too low a weight, especially if you're not going to be able to maintain it.
So when you look at pacing on that too, that could affect it so much, and we're looking at just 1 watt being difference, right? Or being the difference, like you just pacing your effort more consistently throughout that could make a difference of much greater than 1 watt, right?
Oh, yeah.
If you go out too hard and then you end up finding yourself in a situation where you're completely gassed, you've just lost so much of an advantage. It's crazy.
And I think a lot of people don't think about it. You know, they think about pacing, or they get to the bottom. Everybody feels great at the bottom, so they start going, they go hard, or and they a lot of times they don't think about the altitude aspect of it either. So as you're starting to lose that oxygen, you know, you basically have to gauge your effort. So if you're pushing 300 watts at the bottom, you're probably not pushing 300 watts at the top.
Yeah.
But the air density is different too, so you actually can go faster on less power as you go up as well. So
it's true.
There's a lot of different variables to kind of take into account when you're starting to look at those kind of big climbs.
Does Best Bike Split accommodate those things, altitude and
We do physics wise. So in terms of how that affects the air density, we do. We do have some updates that are in the works for right now. You can kind of change the model based on altitude, but we kind of assume that you're racing in a similar type of altitude. So meaning that, like, if most of the race is around 6,000, 8,000 feet, we kind of assume that it's around that. If you're going from 0 to 14, that's a different beast, right?
Yeah.
So what we would do for that is then we would pull those adjustments into the model itself, as opposed to trying to plan it before you run the model.
Oh, okay.
So then basically adjusting kind of those, what's the perceived effort at 14 versus what that perceived effort would be at sea level.
Gotcha.
And then adjust the plan based on that.
Okay. Hmm.
So when I'm looking at, can we get into some of like the common mistakes that you see some athletes make?
Yeah,
I'm looking at,
I got a first question on that.
Yeah.
When should I, on a climb, let's say I have a deeper dish wheel that's like 150 grams heavier than a smaller, like I'm using air quotes, climbing wheel.
Yeah.
When is that like, when do you swap? When do you go one over the other?
Yeah, that one's kind of a tricky one, because you also have the you know, we like to model things in an easy fashion where you have all this steady state stuff going on. And when you're out there riding, especially uphills and things like that, you're not going steady state. It's all these micro accelerations and decelerations. So, you know, for that kind of stuff, the climbing wheel is, you know, it's going to be good because it's easier to accelerate up to speed. The heavier wheels are a little harder to accelerate, so you have to spend more energy to get them up to speed. Now, if you could maintain a steady speed, then, you know, that same kind of rule applies. Once the aerodynamic benefit stops, you know, you go 15, 13 miles an hour, then you'd want to switch over. But because of those little accelerations and things, you know, you may pump that up to 15, 16 miles an hour, somewhere on there, if it's a pure climbing kind of environment. So, yeah.
Same thing with, like, if I'm a choice between an aero road helmet or like a lighter helmet.
Yeah. And a lot of that is, you know, the aerodynamics of it would say always go with the more aero helmet, but because you have the physiological impact of it, of trying to stay cool, heat and humidity, how does your body react to that kind of heat? Is your core temperature rising too fast? And then that's going to affect your power. So not being able to push the same power. So you see a lot of athletes, bringing it back to Kona, have to make that choice. It gets hot, it gets humid here. Are they still, should they go with the aero helmet that's going to give them that extra 2 minutes? Or is that going to cause them to blow up and they can't run?
Yeah.
So you kind of have to make that trade-off. And I think somebody like Ben Hoffman, you see, will almost always ride, you know, kind of a mixed aero road helmet instead of a pure aero helmet for that reason.
So let's say I'm doing a climb and I'm going to average 10 miles per hour and heat's not a factor.
Yeah.
Should I go aero road every time?
Yeah, I don't think it would really. I mean, at that point, you know, those kind of speeds, it's going to be minimal, right? So your gain of that aero helmet versus a road helmet is pretty negligible. So
okay.
At that point, it's what comfort? can you get comfortable?
I would see that as maybe at that point it's a wash, but the whole rest of the ride, that is not that climb. I just think that some people think that, oh my gosh, my light helmet's going to be such a big advantage over it, but it's not.
Right. The actual weight of the helmet is not going to be. That's completely negligible.
Yeah.
I mean, you had an extra water bottle, it's way more than what that's going to be.
Totally.
Right? So you think about it that way. I mean, two and a half pound water bottle that you know you're going to have, you know, it's the extra 90 gram, 80 grams on a helmet, it's not going to be that much difference. So
we see a lot of debate too on, especially nowadays, because the bikes are becoming a little bit more of like a compromise, or in some cases kind of like a Swiss Army knife, but the choice between aero road bikes and then a standard road bike. And that's a tough question, I think, that a lot of people have too. Like for example, Nate has the S-Works Venge Bias, right?
Yep.
So it's that bike, at least, so I'll just quote the marketing, right? So the marketing behind that tells us that it is probably the bike with the most, aero road bike with the most R&D behind it.
Yeah, so they say.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's got a huge amount of effort and shaping, and everything's integrated, everything else. But that versus a tarmac, have you had any insights or worked with teams to kind of help them decide on that end? Or any insight at all?
We have, and in some of the tour side, we've worked with some of the teams on choices, bike setups. A lot of times it's about which bike can get the athlete in the best position, right, for the race. Because, you know, regardless of the marketing, you know, a lot of times you're testing a bike in the wind tunnel by itself, you know, or with some wheels. There's no rider on it. So yeah, if that bike and that other bike were going down the Queen K against each other with no rider on it, this one's going to gain X amount of time right. over the other one. But you can throw a rider on it, and then that gets diminished really, really quickly. So, you know, there is still a distinct difference between bikes, but you look at it, and it's probably not as big as the marketing says. So I would say, you know, if you're going to do a climb or a predominant climb, then it's going to be pretty negligible between bikes. Wheels will change it because that's the front kind of leading edge of what the wind's hitting. But it's almost more about can your athlete get in the right position on the bike.
So. It makes sense. I mean, there has to be this data or this decision making is going on because Sagan just won world championships on a tarmac, not Avenged Bias. He's won a bunch of the stages that he won this year in all the different races. He was on a tarmac, not the Avenged Bias. He was on the tarmac more than he was on that. And that's really interesting to me. Like,
yeah,
you know,
it doesn't,
it's less aero.
It doesn't mean that it's necessarily the better choice, though.
Exactly.
Like, have you ever seen pros do things that are not the,
yeah,
like,
exactly.
the modeled right? He's laughing.
Yeah, but he strikes me as somebody who knows the right tool for the job. I mean, yes. He knows the bike that works the best for him.
Right. And for that, I mean, if you look at it, how much time is he going to spend out front leading, you know, during the race? I mean, he's gonna lead at the right spot where he needs to, and he's gonna have the right power that he needs at the right spot. Okay. So, you know, for him, maybe, you know, that sprint acceleration with a little bit light, being able to really accelerate that bike, and it may just have felt better when he's sprinting it before.
Totally.
So
mental too. Yeah.
And handling comes, you know, and I know that this isn't exactly what we'll be talking about in this one, but handling as well. And we know that a lot of aero bikes do compromise, whether it be comfort, whether it be rigidity, or anything else. It could go on either sides of that fence, but a lot of aero bikes, because they're going for a different objective, do sacrifice other aspects of performance of that bike, so it makes sense.
My choice, like my Venge Vias, it's an extra large, and I have CLX 50, so pretty deep wheels on it, and it's 18.1 pounds. Yeah. That's big.
It's a heavy bike.
And the new Tarmac, I think I could probably get it for me, that's under 14 pounds, but by the extra light one. So that's it's like a 4-pound difference, maybe. Like,
so we can throw that in Best Bike Split and see what the 4-pound difference. And that's an actual real. Yeah. I mean, especially if there's some hills and during. You know, you think about a sprint, right? So if you're going out and it's, you know, mass times acceleration, and you're going out, so you're going out and you're pushing this big power, and that's going to accelerate faster. I mean, it's mm-hmm. going to be. Maybe it's just a little bit, but you only need to win a sprint by a little bit.
That's so. Right.
I always thought, though, too, is what's how do I want to win a race? It's not sprinting, never.
Right.
And I'm probably never going to win on a hill. I won't win on a hill climb. I like doing breakaways by myself. So that's made me think of more aero bike.
Oh, for sure. And I think what you'll see is, dependent on the type of rider and what the plan is for that rider, especially on these teams, you know, they'll set up their equipment that way. So, you know, you're not going to see, I mean, you may see Contador on a big break, and he's done it many, many times, but you see him do that in hilly, you know, hilly terrain. So,
right.
And in descending, you know, they're so technical that, you know, a lot of the descents on a lot of these races, that it's not pure aero. It's how can you handle your bike, and you want to be able to handle it well.
You're braking, so. And once you start braking, you're really, like, you're ruling all of those aspects out.
And again,
much.
You have those deceleration, acceleration. If you have a lot of those, then you want something you can handle, something that's going to transfer the power well. And that doesn't make some of those aero sacrifices may make sense for that.
Mm. Yeah, I think I know the right answer. It's buy both bikes.
Yes, that's always the right answer. Right?
Yes, buy more of them. So are you guys working with any team or any, and you don't have to give specific names here or anything else like that, but when you go to an event like this, what are you doing for these athletes? Or are you working with any athletes like that? And what's the objective? How do the athletes, what do they want to know?
Sure. I mean, here in Kona, it's weather. So everybody wants to know, you know, kind of what the forecast is going to do. How's that going to impact the race? At a normal Ironman or normal triathlon event, it's very time trial like. It's very here's my watts. Here's what I can do. What kind of time can I get? What can I expect? But at this World Championship event, everybody's so good. They're all so amazing that it becomes a much more tactical race. So what you see in the prevailing weather conditions here are such that on the way out of town, you kind of have this mild headwind coming off the interior of the island. You make the turn to head back up to Javi, where the big climb is, and the weather starts to change. It's a different microclimate, so you start to get this bigger headwind. So you have a mild headwind to a little bit bigger cross headwind. You make the turn, and now the weather has shifted over the top of the island, and the prevailing wind starting to kick in. And so you have this big kind of tail cross coming back off down Javi at the times that they're going to be riding. And then when they start heading to the airport, it's turned and has come all the way around, and you have the sea breeze coming in, and so it's a growing headwind throughout the day. So you have headwind to crosshead to crosstail for a brief period, back to headwind. So there's almost no reprieve whatsoever. And so when you think about it that way, you've in the last couple of years, you've seen kind of these, and maybe even the last four years, you've seen these kind of bigger packs forming on the way out of town. And even at, you know, the 12-meter legal distance, with a straight headwind, you are still getting an advantage. And that advantage at the power they're doing can be anywhere close to 20 watts. So
holy
if you
cow.
Have these people so up front pushing 280, 290 watts, you have other people pushing 260, 250, you know, in that pack. Now there's a
huge
lot of acceleration, so that does put some pain on the legs, especially towards the back. And because of the passing rules, if you break somebody's plane, now you don't just have to pass that one person, you have to pass those
every
15 people all the way to the front. So
all
that so there's some tactics that you have to play in that and say, you know, how can I race this? But you'll see the big moves happening in that crosswind section at the turnaround of Javi where there's no more advantage.
Yeah.
And that's where the strong cyclist will say, I've got to put big distance in now. So that's kind of how it tends to play out.
When I look at that too, you mentioned earlier actually in a conversation that we were having that changes over time too. So in other words, the winds that you laid out, if you were the type of rider that maybe you got out of the water slower or you just didn't you didn't carry a good pace in the first part of the bike, you're actually going to get different wind conditions.
Yeah, you're going to have a different ride.
Right. It's funny, I was talking to Luke McKenzie and he got second here. And we talked about this, can you beat the wind? And that's what these guys, the really good swimmers with strong that are strong cyclists, which there aren't a lot of those in the last few years. There haven't been people that have gone out and come out of the water sub 50 and then really biked hard. There's typically the people that are riding really hard come out 4 minutes back on the swim, mm-hmm. and they're trying to play catch up. This year we've got Josh Amberger, and he's kind of a, he may be first out of the water, 47 type minute, and then he can push 310 watts on the bike. So you may see him come out and really, for the first time in a long time, try and beat the wind. And if you can do that, now you're not talking about a 2 or 3 minute gap, you're talking about a 10 minute gap coming off. So it may force the tactics to change a little bit this year.
That'd be super interesting. Is there any, and I know that this perhaps is a better question for a meteorologist, I don't know, but I've noticed that in canyons and in mountainous environments as well, where you'll get a headwind switch. It's like when it's colder in the morning, it seems like the wind likes to drop down the canyons. And then, you know, in the afternoon, when things heat up, it seems to switch. But have you noticed anything like that? Is there a common principle with that?
I mean, here it's about that. It's just the way the island is set up and the way the prevailing winds are, that you kind of get this wrap around the island. So yeah, it's sheltered. It's fairly sheltered kind of on the way out when it's coming off the main, you know, coming off the inland. But then here around 10 o'clock, around 10:15, you start to get the prevailing sea breeze that starts to pick up. And we can kind of feel it here. It's very nice here when we get the wind coming in. It's not going to be so nice when the breeze picks up for the athletes coming in. They also have these storms that'll pop up. And we had one this morning that popped up and the wind just got out of control. So, you know, if that does happen, hopefully it happens early and they get a nice little tailwind out of the beginning. But it's definitely, I think every little, you know, every microclimate has its own prevailing kind of things that happen. But here, that tends to be the way it turns out.
For those who don't know, triathlons, unless it's ITU, you can't draft, right? But you, like, I'm using air quotes, draft. There's no pack riding. So when Ryan says pack, he means, like, it's a very long single file line. And the pros have a 12-meter space between it. It's like front wheel to front wheel, right?
I believe so. Front wheel to front wheel.
Yes.
And there's markers on the road that are 12 meters apart. So if they're on the one marker and you're on the other marker, then you're good. And so that's kind of how they space it out.
Then an age group, it's 9 meters, I think?
10 meters.
10 meters? So at an age, for an age grouper who's an age group triathlete, and they're at 10 meters, and at, let's say at a typical
you know, good age group speed, what kind of like watt savings would they get by being in that draft?
So it's interesting. So we did some analysis on this not too long ago, and we're looking at, you know, somewhere between, if it's a headwind, so if there's a crosswind, it alleviates any of that. So there's no longer, you know, even a little bit of a crosswind. But if you have kind of a direct headwind or no headwind or no wind at all, you're looking at maybe an 8% drag difference. So an 8% drag difference could be somewhere near 4 or 5% watt difference, depending on the speed. So the lower the watts, the lower the difference. The higher the watts, the bigger the difference. So in the pros pushing 300 watts, you could 20, 25 watts. Once you get down under 200 watts, now you're looking at 5, 10, you know. So it kind of scales with it. So
it's still significant, though.
Still significant.
Totally is.
Another thing that age groupers can do that pros can't is when you come up to pass, you can be in someone's draft, correct?
Correct.
So then what kind of, like, I always heard like a rule of thumb of like 1 second per person you pass that you could save.
Probably. I know there's that slingshot effect kind of, right? So where they get in behind somebody and then they go out and then they get in behind. And I know talking to some very good female age group athletes, they utilize that when they're going past the guys quite often because they're smaller and they're going through these guys and they're kind of using that to propel them. I mean, it's all legal, but it's still just a... you know, it's part of the tactical part of racing.
Yeah, when I was racing age groups, sometimes they're jumbled for the start order, and my age group was in the back, and there was a headwind, and there was just a huge line of age group athletes, but I was strong enough to go through all of them, but also get that legal draft over and over and over
again.
That's
smart.
And I did it was great. That's a good tip.
We actually did a podcast on this last year from Kona with Matt Lieto all about try tactics. So if you want to find one there, check that out. And we go over all the crazy things that he does to to get advantages and that other riders do. So.
Is there a specific point where you have to swing out of that draft when you're approaching a rider?
Yes, you have a certain amount of time between each rider to get around. I think it's 20 seconds, something like that.
Yeah,
so you have a, but you have to complete the pass in 20 seconds. So there's not a lot of time that you're back there, especially if suddenly they go a little harder and they do give out penalties here for that. Many of the pro field got penalty last year. So Patrick Lang, who got third last year, had a penalty, not for drafting, but for blocking or not passing. So something that, where he had to sit out for whatever 5 minutes and then ended up breaking the run record here. So I don't know if that helped him or not. But it definitely changed his bike strategy. He got it early in the bike, so then the rest of the bike, he biked very controlled by himself. Biked a little bit slower, but then had that amazing run to close the gap.
It's something that Matt was mentioning, the fact that he said that you can kind of tell when certain riders are going to pass, and he said that he would try to anticipate that in some circumstances and just pick up the pace just ever so slightly.
Just a little bit.
And if you pick that up just before then, when you know they're going to pass, then they know, well, if I try to make this pass, it might take me more than 20 seconds to get around him or whatever the limit is. It's hugely tactical, and I think that most cyclists especially just don't understand how tactical that is.
Pro race here, is amazing, especially at these championship events. We were at Chattanooga as well, and to see that, it was interesting because you knew Sebastian Kienle, super strong cyclist. He had a very poor swim there. Came out almost over 4 minutes down in the swim there. And so you have 56 miles to try and bridge that gap, and he was going like a mad, you know, madman. At least 330, you know, big watts, pushing it the whole way. But as soon as he made a pass on Javier Gomez, Tim Don, a lot of the kind of people that were in this long line of cyclists, he made the pass, and they just didn't let him go. They said, okay, we're going to sit here. And there was a headwind coming back in. They set in, and, you know, he finally broke the elastic. But, I mean, he had to work really, really hard, and then it showed in the run. He wasn't able to – they outran him. And so he wasn't able to kind of make that big charge that he normally does.
So you've seen a lot of power files for professional athletes. What kind of, like, for a top – let's say biker at Kona, what's their power to weight ratio, and then what kind of watts, like normalized power, would they hold for the course?
Okay, so I'll kind of give you some extremes, right? Yeah. So Lionel Sanders shares all his data. He's very, very interesting person, probably the biggest power pure triathlete out there. So for like a 70.3, he will hold 350 watts, 355 watts.
And he's a pretty small guy in terms of height, right?
He's a pretty small guy. He's very solid. So he's around 170 pounds, you know, around
brick.
There. He's a brick. It shows in the swim sometimes. We'll see how he's been working on it a lot, so we'll see how it comes. But we've talked to him. He's a very big student of the game. So he's this is third year here, and he's every single time he's learned something. So we'll see how he applies it now. But so that's kind of the extreme for a race like Kona. He'd probably do 310 somewhere around there, normalized. He's in the past. He's tried for 330 and seen it.
Didn't pan out.
See it 280 at the end of it. So you go out at 330, 280 into a headwind on the way back. So I think he'll be a little more conservative because he has a really good run afterwards as well. So I'd expect somebody like Josh Ehrenberger, who's first time here, pushed 320 coming out of the gate. But then you see some people like Frodeno or some of these athletes that, obviously extremely good, they know that they need to back it off. And so they may be capable of doing 290 or 230 or 290 or 300 here, but they'll go in and ride 260, 270.
Wow.
They're still going extremely fast. They're still very aerodynamic, but now they can get off and they haven't overstressed themselves and they can run. And they can run really, really well, because that's where you win the race here. You don't win it on the bike. Yeah. A lot of people would love it if it was over after the bike. But unfortunately, there's a whole other section.
We would be triathletes.
Yeah, exactly.
So what kind of time are they doing then for holding, let's say, 270 or 290 watts?
So again, based on the weather, it's that beating the wind thing. If they're doing 270 watts and they're out early on the bike and they're in that nice little pack, I mean, they're still doing sub 430. So you're looking at somewhere between, depending on the weather, 425 to a 430. And Lionel Sanders is maybe doing a 4:23 because he's later on in the swim and he's having to make all that distance up, so he's pushing higher power to bridge the gap, but he's not going that much faster. So he may be going 3 or 4 minutes faster, but for a much higher power.
Mm. And a huge energy cost that comes from that.
Yeah, for sure. What about pro cyclists? You've seen some of that stuff in Tour de France. Can you, anything you can share or not share?
I probably can't go into names, but you're looking at some of those top guys are for a time trial. Let's say a 40K time trial. I mean, you're looking at 420 to 450. It's pretty insane. So like a Wiggins kind of hour record type of stuff, 450 plus or 445 plus is not inconceivable. So it's definitely a different. That's all they do. That's all they train for. And so those big power riders that are time trial specialists, so can definitely be up in those high numbers.
Do you see that they pace better than or do they do something unique in their pacing that us amateurs don't do?
It's interesting. Well, I mean, the higher power, the kind of easier it is to pace, right? But I think because you can keep a low VI.
What's VI?
Variability index. So that difference between normalized and average power, kind of keeping that low. The rule of thumb is 0.05 or under for most time trial type courses. So 5% maybe higher, a little bit on normalized than your average. And they naturally pace themselves so well, the best ones do. They've just been doing it for so long. So you take away their computer, you take away their power meter, they're still riding the same. But then you do see pros, and I have a story, and I can't go into who it was, but at the Tour of California, we said, it was a couple of years ago, and they had the Vail time trial, and we were saying, oh, sorry, the
Big Bear one.
Yeah, Big Bear.
Or Bear Lake. I can't remember. Yeah, Bear Lake.
Well, actually, no, I say the Colorado. It was the Colorado, so it was the Vail one. So,
okay.
But they had this honking tailwind coming out, and so they had a tailwind going out, turnaround, and then it was a climb to the finish. And so you had this huge tailwind, and we were telling them, okay, so you're only going to push, and it's at altitude, so you're like, you're only going to push 340 watts going out. Just, kind of take it easy. 340 watts going out, you're going to make the turn, and then as you start to climb, you're going to ratchet that up. And so you're going to be 380 coming back or 390 coming back, then it's going to be 400, then 410, and then hopefully whatever you have left at the end, if you can push 430 at the end, it's going to be great. So that's what you tell him beforehand. Then what happens is he goes out at 410 with the tailwind, fastest person to the to the turnaround, fastest person to the turnaround, but lost 2 minutes going the other direction because his power went from 410 to 400 to 380, and he finished at like 360. And so you're looking at that as a complete opposite, and you gain that 2 seconds going out to lose 2 minutes on the back half. So
tailwinds could be an opportunity to just utilize that momentum and then save that energy for later if it's needed like that.
Right. Or, you know, here at Kona, use the right places to do things like stretch out, take nutrition. So, like, the places where you're going to lose the least amount of time for changing your position, stretching out, so you already have that momentum going. If you're in a headwind and you sit up, it's like you're giving away time. You're just, like, kind of... Yeah, so whereas if you have a nice tailwind, you can kind of stretch out. You're not losing very much for that.
Would a climb, too, be a part where you could reach in your back pocket and get out some food or something?
For sure, especially, I mean, if you can do it. So, if you're able to, like, reach back and kind of relax a little bit, take a drink, and you're here, hopefully you're not redlining it anywhere on the course, and you can be able to do that.
We can attest to how difficult that is, though, to not redline on this course. Like, perhaps the thing that people don't understand is the fact that the course is hilly. It has very flat sections, but then as soon as you get out to Javi, it's got some substantial fluctuation that goes on in the pitch. So it's certainly not a cakewalk in terms of just like pacing a flat time trial.
So do you have something to say about that, Ryan?
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say, I think it's almost 5,000 feet of climbing or something like that over the course. So, and Javi is a section of that, but it's only a part of it. There's all those rollers going out and it's net positive gradient going out. And you think, oh, good, it's going to be negative grading going back, but you have all those rollers. So once you get down from Javi, you still have some significant, you know, feet that you have to climb. So.
Totally.
So Andrew Chelansky, we just had him on the podcast, and he's joining the Tri World. What advice for, like, a race strategy would you have for, obviously, an Uber biker?
Yep.
He told us, too, he's pretty aerodynamic, right? And even in the Tour, he could put out less power for the same speed as other guys. And then, but... Let's say his swim, we don't know what it's going to be, but let's assume it's not going to be first pack. Mm-hmm. What would you tell him to do?
So, here it's kind of it's tricky. In a normal triathlon, I would say, okay, you come out and then you hit your watts and you're going to pull them back in at some point and then you're going to have to use your strength. So, you hit your 80% or your 75% of your FTP and then you're naturally going to go past people because... your FTP is going to be higher than most people racing. Here, it's a little bit different. Because of those weather conditions, he's probably going to have to push pretty hard on the bike. And so to bridge that gap, because if you don't bridge that gap by the time you get to Javi and make that turn and are coming back in, then you're not gonna catch those lead guys. So you're definitely going to have to use your strength here and push hard early to try and bridge that gap. Once you bridge it, you can rest a little bit, take some time, and then once you make the turn, you can really turn it on in that crosswind where there's no advantage and start to put those big gaps into people.
So that's what you do. You put out most of the power. And how, if you're racing at, let's 0.75 or 0.8, what? How much?
And sorry, that's 0.75, 0.8. What is it?
Percent of FTP.
Perfect.
So, how high would you go? And even for an age group, if you did have a crosswind, you're like, hey, this is the time to for me to get some advantage on people.
So I would say that's on the high end. So that's I would usually not say to do that here. Like a 0.7, 0.8 is really, really high. But if you're a cyclist that races weeks and weeks at a time, so your stamina and what you can hold under FTP is probably quite a bit higher than what a normal triathlete would be. So typically here, you know, it's almost point for an age grouper 0.65 to 0.7, and even if you look at for Dano holding 0.67, I mean, just kind of, it's almost easy. It's almost like he's spinning it out.
It's
here.
Crazy.
But he can do that because he knows he can run. So the cyclists that are going to have to bridge that gap, they're going to have to go harder. So Sanders is going to go harder than that, 0.75. And somebody like Cameron Wharf is going to have to go harder than that as well. So he's another professional cyclist that's moved over to triathlon. So definitely you're going to have to play to your strength, and it's going to be a different strategy for them than it would be a typical age grouper.
Now, the percentage of FTP, it changes based on how long it takes you, right?
Yep.
So I'm going to give you a couple Ironman finish times. Can you give me like an age grouper, like kind of range of percent IF?
Sure.
Let's say 5 hours. Like that's a fast age grouper, right?
So that's a fast age grouper, and it kind of depends on where their FTP is. But let's say 250 or something like that, or no, that's probably low. So let's say 280 or something FTP for that. That's probably a 0.7 or a point right under somewhere on there.
530.
That's a pretty hard effort.
So 530 would be less than that. So you're looking at 0.67 or somewhere around there.
And then 6 hours?
Anything, anything six or above, it's kind of like, 0.6, 0.62, and or, you know, just out there and doing what you can kind of thing. Yeah.
So when people listening, if they could bike it probably at a, or they could bike it at a higher percentage FTP, but then you're walking a marathon, right?
Yeah. And that's really what it's about. It's about the total stress load that you get throughout the ride. So, you know, if you go out there and really just crush the ride, and we saw some people do that last year, really good age groupers. One age grouper rode 330 watts out here last year. Wow. I mean, he was a very big big cyclist, and he had done that before and run okay. And out here, you can't do that. He comes out here and he walked a good 20 miles of the marathon. So,
ouch.
Wow. Yeah. And that's a lot of that, we keep talking about how it's exceptional here. The wind makes it exceptional, but really it comes down to the heat and humidity, right?
Right, and can that athlete perform in this kind of condition? Have they acclimated to this kind of condition? You see some people, Daniela Reef came over to Hawaii right after Chattanooga, so she's been here for a month, you know, training and getting ready.
I think same with Keenly as well, yeah.
And so you see some pros do that, and other pros, you know, that Andy Potts flew in 2 days ago. So he's been raced here many, many times, so he kind of knows what it's like. But
and I know a lot of them are using sauna training too. So like whether they do their indoor workouts in a sauna or right after their workout sitting in a sauna, I've heard that a lot of them are using that as well to prep. So.
I think Lionel Sanders is another example of that where we've seen some of his videos training, and he's sitting there. He trains almost entirely indoors, and he's sitting there and he's got all the – I think he even had a sauna. Yeah, he had the humidity cranked up to 80%. Temperature, you know, heater's blowing, 80 degrees, and he's just running on the treadmill, and it's just, you know, sweat everywhere. So a lot of athletes have been doing that, and even age groupers are doing that as well. So.
Oh, yeah. We've done it.
Yeah, we do it. Yeah.
I train in the shower sometimes.
Yeah. Ryan, what's one, like, aerodynamic get that age groupers that you see them, like, not do that they could get, either triathlon or road, or probably both?
Mostly it's position. So, I mean, you look at it, and there are a lot of really good age groupers that are pushing out big power, and a lot of them are afraid to change their position once they see that power drop. And trying to get them to say, like, okay, even if your power drops 5%, if you're in a much better position where you're – I like to look at it and say, hey, if you look at your picture and it looks like a barn door and it doesn't look like, you know, look at Sebastian Keenly and then look at you, and you're somewhere between a barn door and Keenly. The more you can look like Keenly, the better you're going to be. Yeah. And so you can give up a little bit of power and still have a much, much faster time. And so I would say position is kind of the biggest thing that I see, because you can buy an aero helmet and you can buy all these wonderful things, but if you're sitting straight up, then it's not going to do you much good. Yeah. So that's kind of the big thing, and it's hard to measure. So
yeah, how do you measure it?
So obviously you can spend a bunch of money, go to the wind tunnel, and I've been to a few now and seen how they do all the wind tunnel tests, which is really interesting. But obviously it costs a lot of money. You can go to velodrome testing. So a lot of people are doing velodrome testing, and that gets really good results. You know, some of the better things, or some of the easier things to do, are just field tests. It's free. We actually have a new beta feature called Aero Analyzer, where you can load previous race files, and it tries to fine-tune that. It's not going to be perfect. It's not a wind tunnel, but at least it gets you in the right ballpark. And then you can say, okay, now I kind of have an idea. Now I can go test some different things, go do some my B races, run that through and see where things are. And I would caution, don't just slam your bars down and try and get as low as you possibly can. It is a progression over time that you need to work with a fitter, you know, a really good fitter, and try and slowly move to where you're not losing all that power right at once, right?
You know, something that we've seen on Elite E-Drive. In fact, this morning I passed a guy, and he had a Shiv. He had the S-Works, you know, he had the TT helmet that they have. He had everything all set up, but the guy's position was just, like, you know, all over the place, right,
and
wacky. I think it's tempting for us to throw some cash at aero gains, but if we're not doing it in the right position, what's really the point, you know?
Well, too, it's hard to hold aero position, especially the way your body's made. And if you can be super aero too, but then if you're my first Ironman, I did this, I was out of aero for probably 3 hours,
right?
Yeah. Just like sitting up,
you and have to be comfortable.
Yeah. So I would have been faster with like being like 2 centimeters higher in the aero bars, but holding that all day long,
right? That's another thing we see. It's like a lot of people, even the people that go to the wind tunnel and pros that we've seen in the wind tunnel and stuff, it's super fast for the 20 minutes at a time that you're testing, but then you get out here and you have to sit and do it for 5 hours. That's, you know, you can give up a little, you know, for comfort, because you also have to run afterwards. So you don't want to be slammed and then get off. And you know, if you're only in your aero position 60% of the time, then it's not a good position for you.
Do you find in working with the teams, and I mean, obviously, other than the fact that triathletes, or actually, I'll just leave it open, the difference between top triathletes and top roads or top people from the road cycling scene, do they have a different mentality toward pacing? Do you see cyclists generally hold a different or hold it in different regard than triathletes?
I think at the elite level, it's pretty similar. So, you know, the elite, like let's say the elite time trialist and the elite triathlete, their pacing is pretty spot on. Like, I mean, again, you take away their power meter, they know their body, they know what it feels like, they know what this grade should feel like when they're going up. It's more on the amateur side, where on both sides of the fence that pacing is poor. And so you get all this adrenaline, you get out of the water, you're just happy to be out of the water finally, because you're like, oh, my body's not sideways, I'm out of the water, let me get on this bike. And so a lot of times you see them crush it out of the, you know, out of transition, and they go up this hill called Polani here, and they'll just hammer it up that as hard as they can.
We got to
get
up in the,
we just got to hammer it to get there. And you go, no. So I think it's more than anything, it's dialing them back on these climbs, and they're going easier than they probably thought they should. And on the downhills, maybe they're pushing it a little bit more than they thought they should. So A lot of times you see people hammer the hills, and then they almost stop pedaling before they even crest over the top of it. And then they're just kind of recovering on the downhills. And, you know, all that change and hard power to nothing and hard power to nothing is going to take its toll on them. And so I think both sides, the amateur ranks, something like Best Bike Splitter or having a plan in general, really helps out.
Awesome. Cool. Do you have anything else, guys?
I'm good. I'm ready to do perfect pacing.
We hear a lot of people ask about like how to pace something and everything else. We mentioned Best Bike Split a lot. Hopefully this is giving you more information on it, because it's a tool that I genuinely use every time I have a race, and I use it regularly. And it's honestly, it's a lot of fun even to just play around with different scenarios and look at what you could do.
I have a question. Does your software allow you to, for instance, if you're chasing a particular finish time, say what level of aerodynamics you have, what level of power will allow you to achieve that, so people can see that, you know, maybe I don't have to push 280 watts, I can actually achieve the same speed with better aerodynamics at 260 watts, do less work, run better as a consequence?
Yeah, one of the features we rolled out maybe 2 years ago was around that, called time analysis tool. So where you can basically say, okay, given this conditions, I want to do a 5-hour bike ride. And then from there, you can say, it'll tell you what type of power numbers you need to have. And then you can start to adjust things, and you can adjust weight, you can adjust aerodynamics, or even power, and then say, okay, what other scenarios can I come up with? Infinite number of scenarios can I come up with to get that same power?
Okay.
So it may be that I get extremely aerodynamic and I can drop my power, and then that will still get that 5-hour. Or I can lose 20 pounds, and you know, whatever. If you have it to lose, you might as well add it in there. But so you can start to kind of do those what-if scenarios.
Awesome.
and get it.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome. I usually use the normalized power model first, and that's you'll see that checkbox, and that's basically allows, that's more or less like a potential pace, right? Like that's like if you were to put out an all-out effort that was well paced.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I usually get curious because it's close to a round number, and I get probably foolish and I enter in the round number and see what I would need to do to hit that. So it's a ton of fun, but it's also super effective, and it helps make you faster. So if you have any questions about Best Bike Split or training in general, go to trainerroad.com/podcast and submit them, and we'll talk to you all next week. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.